Welcome to Subject to Power. I'm El Kemihira. No other conversation I've had has reminded me more of how important context is, as this talk with my guest Shaida Jansen. As she says, the minute something is out of sync with its context, you're busy with lunacy. And we do return to that point throughout the episode. Shaida Jansen is a clinical psychologist specializing in masculinities, working out of Cape Town, South Africa. Early in her career, Shaida became unhappy with how devoid of context her field of psychology was. And from that frustration, she gradually began experimenting with reintegrating, recontextualizing, pulling back together elements that Western-style thinking has compartmentalized and split apart. Men from women, ancient from modern, culture from science, thinking from feeling, self from others. And in this episode, we talk about the work Shaida has done and continues to do to put the pieces back together, and how she uses her wholeness approach to tend to the men in her all-male therapy groups. Thank you for hopping on with me at the end of your day. I have so much I want to talk to you about. I find your work so interesting. So you're a clinical psychologist and researcher and deputy director of academic and ICT support at the University of South Africa's Paro campus in Cape Town, South Africa. Is that right?
It's a regional office. It's a regional, the University of South Africa, the main campus is in Pretoria. And it's got satellites all over the country. So it's national. So we are the Cape Town campus.
Got you.
So that's really the university that I'm working for. So in this job that I am not in the role of a clinician.
Okay, I see.
So of course, I'm a clinical psychologist registered with the Health Professions Council. But in this context, I'm a student affairs professional.
Yeah, I understand. So what I want to focus the conversation on is the book that you wrote, which is called Masculinity Meets Humanity, an Adapted Model of Masculinized Psychotherapy. It tells a story essentially of how you devised masculinized, it's a very hard word to pronounce, group psychotherapy, and you wrote a book about it. And in your book, you go very deeply into the reasons why you devised these programs, but you also ask very straightforward questions about why not. And you say something that really rang true with me, which is we need to ask whether men perceive themselves as part of the social fabric of society or an exclusive brotherhood of men, and that not including men in social repair strategies makes no sense. And so you wrote that, which I think is so very important and apt. And so can you tell me a little bit about your story, how you came to this work? You begin with talking about what the psychiatry field looked like that you found when you began doing this.
I think for me, I qualified as a clinical psychologist, and in fact, I left Cape Town to go train full-time in Joburg. And when I got back after a number of years, I was a fully qualified clinical psychologist, but I didn't feel like one, okay? I felt foreign and strange. And so initially, I actually worked as a researcher full-time and did not introduce myself as a psychologist at all. And when I got to took on a job much later at the University of the Western Cape, a mainstream university, but historically disadvantaged university, I was surrounded by students, the clients, the psychology clients, because I was a head of this student support service, counseling service. I trained and supervised master's level intern psychologists. So they would complete their masters and they would come spend a year with me so that they can be supervised and trained and meet the requirements for the Health Professions Council to be able to register as a psychologist. So I was the supervisor and the trainee for about 8 years, right? While I was there, I then had an opportunity to adapt the counseling service to its context. Because the kind of counseling that I was taught in fact, that even most psychology students in South Africa are taught it, is directly imported, like a Western model. And there's nothing wrong with that. We can import as long as you adapt. Because remember, the latest science confirms that reality is determined by context. So the minute something is out of sync with its context, you're busy with lunacy, all right? You're busy with something that can be extremely harmful. And of course, I don't have to go into it. There's so much literature on the problem with this psychology that get mass distributed in all the far corners of the world, like lots of other things, you know, that in our modern world gets transported, but without adaptation. What I then started at the University of the Western Cape, because remember now, for the first time, I was head of a student counseling center. It was hectic, you know, no resources. And I was a trainer, crisis manager, and administrators. You know, it was quite a difficult position. But I guess I had lots of passion. And so the first thing I started was to develop a group therapy program. Now, remember, psychology also is largely individual therapy, strictly individual therapy. For me, it was like, here I am. Remember, it is now also a scientific fact that the first people are from Africa. We are the first people, all right? And Africa has got a very vibrant philosophy about who we are, what it means to be a human, what it means to be a person, all right? And so I thought that this is very strange. Why is there no, in, you know, group therapy? And I started the first group therapy program I developed from scratch. There was no records, and I had to develop record keeping. Even the protocol, how to do a group therapy presentation. As I was doing that, one day I was busy recruiting for the next group. Then only men arrived at this first group therapy session. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, but being an early adopter, and, you know, I'm adaptable, I'm very much a change maker. And I said to myself, oh, okay, maybe I must just do this, you know, and I did it. And then I, because, you know, I was forward thinking, I then developed an evaluation form, and I had a verbal evaluation conversation with him. What was this like for you? There was no girls here. There was no women, you know. Actually, they enjoyed it. I liked it, although I wasn't quite sure what I was doing. Spoke to my supervisor about this, and he was a very experienced clinical psychologist, a male, Willem. And I said to Willem, you know, this happened. But I said to him, you know, I quite like this, you know. And he said to me, go for it, Shada. And I then started to, I changed the therapy as I was working with these young men, and I adapted it slowly to be masculine reflective. Wrote my PhD on it a few years later, you know. And so I literally, the men that I worked with taught me how to work with it. I was adapting the therapy. I made it more reflective of its context, aligned with its context. And then this accidental men's group happened, and then I slowly learned and adapted the therapy to be masculinized.
And I want to dig into a lot more of that. So the therapy field that you entered, a couple of things stuck out to me, that it is very female dominant and very white.
So, you know, it's a very interesting thing that happened over this time, and I don't have staff. A lot of my clients suffered from food insecurity. They're homeless. So you also need to take that broader social context into consideration. South Africa, we've got 11 languages. right? I mean, my homeland, which is Afrikaans, which was because we were colonized by the Dutch, and Afrikaans happened from Dutch. So I can hear when people speak Dutch. They sound funny to me, and I sound funny to them when they hear me speak Afrikaans, right? So this is also the very interesting context that I'm in, the post-colonial context, right? What you must also understand, the difficulties in terms of offering effective group therapy was more the problem of the therapist than the client. When I interviewed the client and in my preparation for them to enter the group, when I asked them, what do you think is the benefit of coming into a group? They would give me all the group therapeutic factors that the doyen of group therapy, Professor Irvin Yalom. Yalom is like a rock star of group therapy. And my clients would tell me, I get different perspectives. I get to learn from others. I get to feel less alone. I can see myself reflected in others. So you are dealing with a client population that completely see themselves in relational terms. Remember, African identity is an identity that is based on belonging. Ubuntu means that I see myself through you. I cannot be without you. And then the minute, so it's not just kumbaya in terms of we belong. The minute I see myself as belonging to you, like now myself, Shahida, because me and you now, you are my sister. We are part of each other. If you are my neighbor, I cannot go sleep if you are hungry. We don't have to be in and out of each other's places, but we need to be close enough so that we can support each other. Because according to Ubuntu, the minute we belong, belonging is what brings the moral component. So belonging is ethical. It's relational, ethical. So the minute we belong, there are rules of obligation. And so for me then, from an Ubuntu understanding, is that when you see men running around, raping, plundering, murdering, you have to ask yourself, what is this? What happened? People, I see how the academics use this gender ideology and well, no, no, this is beyond gender ideology. And I'm not disputing that there's gender ideology, you know, but I think there's something far deeper and more complex that has gone wrong than a man deciding I define myself in according to hegemonic masculinity. I don't dispute those ideologies, you know, but you need to factor in if you have had a colonial regime for almost 400 years, and I do not want to begin, I mean, the literature is filled with the migrant labor, how men were removed, how the women were raped, you know, like I'm from mixed race, so my ancestors' mothers were raped by these colonizers, and that's partly how the definition of colored came, you know, like I'm defined as colored in South Africa. So part of my then working with men was also to visibilize the kind of injuries that men have suffered, because we tend to make male suffering invisible. We say men are just like that because they are, you know, hegemonic masculinity. And I'm like, no, no. I think that's for me, I guess, why I started to develop the therapy in the way that I did. And let me tell you something, Ellie, you know, in all the 15 years that I've sat opposite men, and I'm talking about poor men, black men of different kind of ethnicities, they have not once objected to my femininity. I have not once had a man be inappropriate. They have been receptive. Some have them bring their wives, or they want their daughters, want to have a better relationship. I want to be a better person. So my experience, and I'm not generalizing my experience, I'm personalizing and I'm saying my experience has been that if I adapt the therapy to who people are, not this anti-gender constructs that is also a modern Western invention that gets imposed on our gender constructs here. Oyaronki Oyawumi, the Nigerian professor from Stony Brook University. I mean, I can't, you know, she's also a legend in what she's done in terms of, but she popularized this thing of this intersectionality doesn't quite get it.
Mm-hmm.
You really, if you want to understand masculinities, gender, femininities, you need to understand and contextualize it according to that context, that history, that politics. Okay? And when I do that, the men I try to understand, they can see I'm coming with respect, and they cry, they share deep stuff, and they make themselves vulnerable. And so I get transformed because of the work that I do.
You do talk about how women and men process things very differently. And part of that is that you have adapted your therapeutic model to men based on that.
So remember now, I'm learning as I'm going along. One of the things that I learned with men, don't be too certain and come with too fixed, rigid understanding of anything. Okay. I mean, I've had conversations sometimes with guys in groups, and some men will tell you they can't have anonymous sex. So often there's a perception that women need the emotion and men can just like get it on. I mean, I've had some men say to me, there must be some emotional connection. Some men, in fact, a lot of the time, they talk like me and you talk. They share stories, you know. So it's verbal, right? And, you know, reflective and stories and emotional and so on and so on. But now here's where you make space for the difference. Because I also believe in the unity of all mankind. You know, I see myself as, I can go anywhere and I feel like, you know, oh, this is my brother, this is my sister, okay? So I believe that all human beings, including men and women, we share. So what would happen sometimes with the men, we'd be talking and discussing some really sensitive things and it's emotional and so on and sad. And then a guy would also then just like crack a joke. Now, among my clinical psychology colleagues, they would, you know, maybe say, well, that's a defensive maneuver, right? What I've learned with men, it's sometimes just form of emotion regulation. You know, they crack a joke and then continue. They're not avoiding. It's like it gets a little bit too tense and then they bring it down and then they can continue. But I roll with that, you know, so they laugh and we have fun and then, you know, then we move again. I do find that the structure works. So I provide a lot of structure at the beginning, set it up, team building, not just coming in there and vomit out your stuff. We first build a culture, which I think is may not even be so masculine as it is cultural. Because from a global South position, whether you go to Japan, Egypt, the Incas, the South Americans, here on the continent, or the Middle East, they call themselves Arabs, we call ourselves Africans, right? We tend to, when we come together, we sing a dance, we pray, we eat, there's a, you know, like to connect as a group. Okay. I do that with my groups. I love it. And they love it. We first connect, right? Some joy, some fun. You invite the whole person into the room. So that's the one thing that I find it helps. And with men then, I think with men particularly, it is about don't talk to me first about that I'm a problem. First, see who I am as a person. Okay? And so we do that. There were times that I would say, come to the first group with something that represents something about yourself that is strong, that is strength. So I think there is a need for structure, but there's also a need for strength-based, which psychology is very much, we were taught, you start with, what is the problem? You make small talk so that you can get to the problem. And then it's, what is the history of the presenting problem? Now, this is sometimes what happens to me when I'm working in a group with men. We do the team building and it's fun. You know, it's like they have to carry this water. And, you know, it's a difficult exercise. By the time they sit down, they've bonded, they're no longer anxious, okay? Then we begin with this, who you are, the Afro-Eastern model of the self, you know? What I've noticed, because now I'm just doing things that affirm them first as humans. I find they themselves will begin to say, no, but this is why I'm here. This is the issue. And they start to talk about the drugging problems, the misses at home, the, you know. I think it's also a cultural thing about the way you do reality, about you don't just go direct, you first go, you know. So I sometimes I'm not sure is a gender, is a culture.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Western therapy is famously individualistic, where you just kind of sit in a room and talk about your inner self without any context or, and certainly not group identity. You mentioned Ubuntu. And I just wanted to, for my listeners who have no idea what this is, I would love to delve a little bit into to that, explain what it means.
So Ubuntu is a Nguni term. So the most spoken language in South Africa is isiZulu, and then isiXhosa, and then there's Ndebele. So the Nguni languages is quite a number of languages. And Ubuntu is a Nguni term that means that I am because of you, okay? That I am because you are, and you are because I am. So it's a term that is central to African philosophy about the self as a relational construct. That there is, in fact, in accordance with African philosophy, there's no such thing as an individual that is separate. The notion of being separate, it is similar in Hinduism, the old Hindu scriptures. The idea of being separate is an illusion, paraphrasing from the Bhagavad Gita. It's the same with Chinese, the Tao. So most of the global South, right, see themselves in this. So when you understand yourself in terms of Ubuntu, it means that you are always both an individual and you are always part of something larger, including the ocean, the forest, the animals, right? The sea, all other people. I think often that is why people do not understand the ravages of colonialism, because when you take the land, when you steal the land, it is not just a physical thing. You are disrupting the culture, the depths of the way the culture has organized itself. Yeah? I'm hoping that this Ubuntu concept is clear.
Yeah. What I find interesting that you talk about is that it takes place, this authentic belonging that you're talking about takes place in a moral order.
So in other words, reality is seen as a moral order. Because the minute you are part of reality, like if I live next to the sea, I have a responsibility towards the fish and the whales and the sharks. You know, I cannot with impunity just fish and my lust for profit and materialism take over. So in other words, everything about your beingness is about submission. Modern Westerners, and I think it's important the timing here of Western society, because remember the old West used to be as relational and as Ubuntu as the rest of the global South. We just need to bear that in mind. And so from an African perspective, then you can never actually extract yourself outside of that moral order. I must eat, you eat. And even when we have conflict, you know, there's a way in which we have conflict. So from that Ubuntu concept, then, for me, working with men, men are seen as perpetrators. Even when they're not the perpetrator, they are automatically assumed. So how, from an Ubuntu perspective, how do you relate to perpetrators? How do we do punishment? So from an Ubuntu perspective, you always see the personhood as a process of becoming more and more Ubuntu, more of the qualities of compassion, of sensitivity, of kindness, right? And so when you err and you're a perpetrator, we see, oh, all right, we need to help this brother to reclaim his personhood, his compassion, his sensitivity, his humanity, because he's lost his humanity. He's not finding it. We need to help him find it, which is a very compassionate way of, what is that form of justice that they say?
Restorative justice.
That's right. With compassion, always understanding you don't punish people in a way that makes it difficult for them to reclaim the humanity.
In the West, we do the very opposite, of course. We exile men. We exile violent men into a violent society of their own. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not that you don't, I'm sure you do that in South Africa as well. So you have another concept that you talk about, which is connected to the Ubuntu, which is a culturally integrated self, which you incorporate in your practice, Umoya. And I found the whole concept of that just super interesting.
I don't think I'll ever be able to repay those students on campus, because I felt very marginalized in my own discipline, right? Very invisible, lonely, you know? And of course, misunderstood. And I was unhappy that there was something missing in terms of the steps of when you start to, in your intake procedure of a new client or at the start of a new group, because it was very clinical for me. And you know what we spoke earlier of, that Ubuntu connecting, singing, dancing, praying together, whatever we do, wherever you go, you know, around in the world, was missing. I think it was in a very unconscious way, because I wasn't even clear what it is that that was missing or what I was looking for. And slowly, I began to experiment. I remember it used to be just this a circle that I used to divide into four. This is the social, this is the psychological, this is the, you know, the way I divided it into the different dimensions. The way the students responded to it, it was always about the way my clients, and mostly the male clients, responded. And they gave me, they were my cheerleaders, right? So they loved it. And then I guess it made me bold. And then I started to look at, what does my own culture say about the self or these dimensions? You know, is there a way of a more organized way? I then got this book by Robert Frager. Robert Frager is the most qualified transpersonal psychologist, an American guy. And he, I think, got involved with the Sufis and all of that, Middle Eastern. And in his book, I then started to see things that I was taught as a child. And then I found this, that the highest form of the self in this Islamic Middle Eastern understanding is the union with God, right? The spirit. And then the dimensions of the self were those dimensions that is in the book. But when I then went to the Nguni version, looked at Xhosa speakers, and I found the same terms and the same dimensions that was in my tradition was in the Xhosa Nguni. Inhliziyo, the heart. Ingqondo, the intellect. Isithunzi, the shadow, which I was thinking. Isithunzi literally means where the sun doesn't shine. So I'm thinking Jung talks about the shadow. And Jung was involved with indigenous communities, right? Then there's the personal power, and then there's, you know. So I learned to speak Xhosa. I can't speak Xhosa, right? But I learned and so on and so on. And then I saw, but remember now, Middle Eastern Islamic religion is now the other day, in chronologically speaking. They new kids on the block when it comes to religion and civilization versus, you know, very ancient civilizations. And I thought to myself, sure, but these Xhosa speakers, the African tradition goes back like ancient. So it seemed to have been preserved. And instead of having a very theistic understanding of spirituality, this Umoya concept is just that at our core, we are wind, spirit. And for me, it is more wide open and it's kind of disconnected from the religious baggage, you know. Whether you're atheist, it's fine. You can't. Whether you hate the idea of God, it's fine. You can see yourself in this kind of complex, multidimensional way. Can I say to you, because by the time that book was published, I did not have the evidence that I have now from some of the latest physics, quantum physics, that physics can now confirm, because Umoya literally means wind. So ancient Africans believed that our essence is wind. So the physics now says that if you look, every cell is made up of about, 100 trillion atoms. The atom is 99.9% vacuum. So that most of who we are as humans is in fact wind. It's vacuum. All right? That the Africans, the ancient Africans, were on the money in the way they saw person. They are not confused by the material presentation. And we also do not reject the material presentation. But what most indigenous people understand is the seamless integration between the spiritual and the material. It's not a contradiction. It's not a problem, you know? So I think for me, when I then start to see a client, whether it's individually or whether it's in the group, that is where we start, not what is wrong with you. But you must now remember the last thing I want to say about this. In a post-colonial context, and I don't think this is written about enough in the literature, what is it that the colonizer attacks? What the colonizer attacks in the indigenous people is related to the unprocessed trauma of the colonizer. Because we never speak about what was the traumatic event that the modern West underwent. What happened to them? Okay? So when I then, because I think it's only afterwards that it started to strike me that when I start the therapy with Ungubani, who are you? Rather than what is wrong with you in the way I was trained. So I don't reject my training. I just make the circle bigger. I put that layer, that extra layer. So it gives the people in my context who have been traumatized by the colonial onslaught on their personhood, because that's what the colonizer attacks. It's who you are, the very nature. That is why women are straightening their hair and putting whiteness on the skin and We hate ourselves as Africans, many of us. Not all, but many of us, you know, because of the attack on the whole personhood. So my model then allows for person to kind of reflect and say, but wow, me now, I'm Ubuntu. I am spirit, I am whole. The way I am, there is nothing wrong with me. My black skin is perfect, you know? So, because injuries and wounds happen at multiple levels, not just at psychological level.
Of course.
Yeah?
Yeah. So I wanted to, you know, another big emphasis of your work is emotional work. And you say emotion or feeling is the great healer, and how key emotions and feelings are to men's healing or men's group therapy.
Your question is very well sequenced, because you're asking me the question after we've spoken about the Afro-Eastern model of the self. But I, so now between us, we now have some idea of what the self is. So contrary to a very reductionistic approach to the self, there are some of my favorite researchers who criticize psychology for absence of models of personhood, like he's my favorite, the late Philip Cushman. Absolutely love his work, and especially the article, Why the Self is Empty. He talks about modern industrialized self, and he talks about emptiness as the disconnect from community. The absence of tradition renders the self mute and naked and vulnerable. So the understanding then of the self is that the self is this social moving spirit. It's not a holy, you know, this very theocentric kind of, no. The self is a moving, dynamic, ephemeral, this kind of spirit. And then that spirit then manifests as, like we say, Xhosa umzimba, flesh, body. So now it makes sense from a biblical perspective. Why is it from a biblical perspective we talk about the body is a temple? Because your body is not just flesh. It's a spiritualized flesh. So that is why your body is not yours. And you see this, my body, and it's my life. And it's like, and for me, you know, from my perspective, I'm like, oh, okay. You know, very foreign, the notion, you know, that because I was socialized that my body is on loan. They call it trust. My body's an amana. It's a trust. And I'm accountable and responsible for this trust. So coming to emotions then, just like your body is spiritualized, your emotions is not just feeling, like psychology would like us to believe, all right? Your emotions is linked to all your other dimensions, your body, your personal power, your spirituality, right? Your intellect. And now the latest affective neuroscience, they confirm that the base of the self actually comes from the brain stem, not from the neocortex, where the thinking neurons come from, okay? So the self actually is, the base of the self is emotion. And in fact, a kind of mindless, an emotion that is not connected actually to what we think of as thoughts, as thinking. It's here, right? From the stem, the brain stem. It means then also that our intellect is built on feeling. So feeling and intellect is never separate. Because that's the other thing that we think, no, I'm not emotional, I'm rational. I'm like, you know, and total confusion, because we are constantly in a state feeling. And so to not be in touch with feelings, it affects the way we're thinking. And we can see that today. Highly intelligent people. And you can see there's no compassion, there's no, the thinking is warped, dangerous. So that's important for me to understand about emotions. It's about the importance of connecting the emotions and not allowing, it's dangerous when you allow for that separation and for that split. So that from a masculine perspective then, the importance that society needs to invest in ensuring that there are spaces that allows men in their own way to reconnect and to pick up on the threads of the feeling that they distance themselves from out of survival. There's a huge survival component. But here's the other thing for me about emotions that I think is important. So you see emotions now more as something that is actually much more than what we think of feeling. It's our very nature is feeling. Because remember Ubuntu. Ubuntu is a way of understanding that our very identity is belonging, which is a feeling. And so you can see the importance and the glue. Feelings ensure that we remain humanized. That we, in fact, it is feelings that rationalizes us. And in the sense of feelings, we become a robotic, dangerous machines, which we can see around us today. Yeah?
Yeah. And men obviously are much more
susceptible
to this. They have been divided from their sisters, in a sense. And you do talk about, too, and I find this in my life and other women's lives, that in these times we call it emotional labor, but emotions, emotional processing, that men very typically outsource that to the women in their lives, or they have these very sort of exclusive emotional processing times with women, not fellow men. And so it's interesting with your men-only groups with no women there to outsource too.
So as you were asking me about men and the susceptibility then to disconnect, to short circuit, literally, right? Emotional connectedness. And that is actually the key reason why you remove women. I have to explain very carefully sometimes in certain contexts, you know, that women are not removed because of reasons of power or, you know, anything like that. In fact, the strategy of removing women is not necessarily even what men's participants agree with. Some of them want women in the group. And you must also remember, it is on that basis that there's a place for me as a woman. I'm the alpha female in the room, yeah? They submit to the power that I have in that group to facilitate their feelings. So, but I also just, before I answer the question directly, what you, I also want to say to you that we need to be careful about the definition of violence, because women are capable of a kind of violence that is very scary and that is not spoken of, and that is swept under. Remember, also I work with women. And in my work with women, I have to give women permission to directly express their anger. And that is also the problem for me in this obsession with splitting in modern Western terms. And when I say modern Western, I do not just mean in your highly industrialized capitalistic societies of the West. I mean in the global South, because we have all adopted those kind of practices, the splitting of men and women from each other. Many societies understand that actually men and women are like this. And you are distorting when you separate and see men as something quite different from women, and they are not. For example, men have difficulty publicly expressing sadness and tenderness, and women have difficulty publicly expressing anger and violence. Okay? So there is a connection between the masculine and the feminine. Also, often what we ascribe to gender is perhaps not of gender, but perhaps of how men subscribe to the societal messages, because men do not fall from trees. And if I look at some of the research that I do and some of the responses of the men that has been in my groups, what I see a repeated pattern is how the men say, but, you know, this is what I'm supposed to do. They follow rules. I think we tend to blame men, because if we don't blame men, we're going to have to turn that mirror onto ourselves as a society. And it's uncomfortable. Men only enact for me the more physical kind of violences. And it's horrible. I'm not at all. I mean, I'm familiar with the statistics and it's horrible. But if you look at the violence that gets committed around very highly supposedly civilized people, you are astounded at how poverty, the deep inequalities, the fact that largest portions of the world doesn't eat, doesn't have a place to live. That kind of violence is never seen in the way we are horrified by male violence. And so it's convenient in a sense for us to masculinize violence. And remember, when we masculinize, we're not just masculinizing, we're racializing. We're talking about black men. Yeah, so I think I just wanted to digress a little bit, you know, so that there's a context and understanding that it's the yin and the yang. And what men and women have in common is personhood. And personhood means relationality and morality. And so just like women are capable of violence that is not so easy to measure, that is not visible, but it has extreme consequences, we need to become a little bit clearer about how we define violence. And we need to also, just like we create spaces for men to express tenderness, we need to express spaces where women can express the anger and the violence. Because many children are unsafe around women. And the research is clear that so many children are being abused by women. And I'm not saying that men are not abusers. Again, it's about the nuances. But also, you know, what is her name? Her name is Eleanor. I'll get to her surname. Also, I love her work. So she talks about from the age of young children when boys and girls begin to separate and they start the same gender kind of groupings. And what she says about that, there's very little difference actually between men and women in general in terms of intelligence or skills or ability. You know that most women can do what most men do. It's not like there's a, you know, difference. However, she says that it is when they are together in social groupings that you need to see the difference in terms of the dynamics that now unfolds, both of the social dimension. And she talks about how boys come together, you know, when they do stuff together, almost like they turn whatever they're doing into like one large project. And it's very adversarial and they jockey, and the way they even speak to each other, you think, you know, they're actually able to understand one another and they successfully complete projects. So when you remove a woman in a men's group, you allow that male dynamic to continue, that they can then be with the feelings in the, like a project. So that is why that one activity that I do where I draw this column, the left-right column, and I say, okay, we're now going to brainstorm some of the most common feelings that your current spouse or partner evokes in you. And then I start having a whole column of which irritates me, frustration, whatever, whatever, right? And then on the next column, I would say, okay, now I want you to go back to your earliest memories of childhood caregivers and doing emotional engagement around the issues, but as a project. So because I'm aware that what this researcher said, it connected with, and then I do it, and it works. I put teenage boys together, it's raucous. We get the work done. And we allow for the sadness to come. Then I'll say, guys, let's just slow this down. Let's welcome the feelings. And it slows down and the feelings come, you know? And sad feelings, sometimes tears. And I've never seen a man shame another man because he's becoming tearful. I've only seen them actually being very, you know, like they also become sad. Look, I'm very clear about the rules of the group. You're not allowed to lectures, no advice giving, okay? So, yeah, I think in the absence of women, they use male icons and male imagery and symbols to explain the feelings. And they also can use that humor, the way they break the sensitivity. And we use some action sometimes. So in the absence of women, women are also faster than men when it comes to feelings. Women are faster and women dive deeper into it. Men, they need a bit of an engine in the room and a bit of a warm-up. Once they're warmed up, they are. I don't see the difference between men and women in terms of being able to process very hard, sensitive feelings. It's a different way of getting there. As a person who works with men, I must be able to also facilitate that very male-specific way of dealing with feelings.
You do talk about also emotional vulnerability or male vulnerability. And I find that interesting. I mean, I think in some ways that we, again, this separation, this splitting, this sort of artificial assigning of emotions, that vulnerability is sort of a female devalued trait, whereas it's actually kind of key to healing. Anyway,
Sure. So again, there, I also think one has to be careful about where and when. So for me, as an African who's grown up more in a very more relational environment, where people are quite emotionally expressive, generally, I find there are certain cultures where people are quite cold and stiff upper lip, and you could see they're not very spontaneous in expressing feelings. So I asked myself, if you're in a culture like that, if the men are not very expressive of their feelings, is that not them embodying what their culture has taught them to be? I'm just trying to complexify things here. And I think this is one of the conversations I've once had with a group of men around. I said, be careful now of this new call for men to be kind of like vulnerable and emotional. Emotional expression is always about where and when. Men may judge each other because remember they have to go out there and compete for what resources, or you're now expecting this man to make himself vulnerable in a public way, and that might jeopardize his standing among other men, depending on what context he's in. Yeah? So I'm really quite concerned about, because why are we asking men to be more emotional? Why are we not changing society so that it becomes easier for everybody to be more emotional? So are we blaming men for something, again, that is really actually a societal dynamic? And I'm not saying men are not guilty of not engaging with their feelings, you know, because I think I'm also biased. You know, I work with men who are expressing their feelings in the context that I create. So maybe I'm biased, you know, but I think it's very important that we are careful and clear about what it is that we're asking for.
You talk about back to the importance of belonging and attachment and how critical that is for a human being, the one side of the all-men group therapy to create positive male attachment.
So I think it's also something that became clearer as I just continued to do it, because psychology taught me to see and look for healing and pathology in a particular way, right? But as I worked more in groups, both with women also on the campus, you know, what became apparent is that for people who see themselves in relational terms, just coming together with others is healing. And I don't think that is only for people from one part of the world. For me, it is primal connection. It's foundational. It's in our DNA. We cannot survive without belonging. So I think that belonging is not recognized in the healing professions for the centrality that it is, for the radicalness that it is. And the one thing that I wish more people can see is how men love to belong. They want to connect. They're human, you know? And so don't say men are not doing their feelings. They spontaneously express their feelings, because when we belong, when we connect, we feel safe. We feel visible. And then we become spontaneous. Then it's not about being female. It becomes about, I'm human. I'm being seen, and I'm being welcomed, you know? And of course, I behave in ways that the therapist is not supposed to behave, you know, with the clients. It helps the clients. They feel like keep boundaries, you know? I'm just talking about, you know, that I'm a little bit more relaxed than what the very rigid way of being with clients, very clinical, strict way of being with clients, that I'm more human. I find that within that lightness and within that more humaneness, and particularly, let me then make this point, because that's maybe an important point to say, is that men are quite sensitive more, maybe, and I'm generalizing now, to overt power dynamics. Mainstream therapy is quite about the hierarchy, the expert. Okay? Now, when you come with that, already the alliance is not going to work. So you're more likely to be successful. Even with teenage boys, 15-year-olds, I get on with them so well because I create a different kind of alliance with them. It's not about my degrees and my position, you know. I'm sometimes just an auntie. They call me sissy, they call me auntie, they call me mama. You have a different way of connecting. Actually, I think men are very sensitive about connection. I think they want to belong, they want to connect, but they are actually like, they're not going to make themselves just vulnerable.
Maybe the consequences for them making, consequences of their vulnerability is greater than the consequences for women. But so how, I know that South Africa has as big a problem with male violence against women as anywhere else.
Huge.
So we wanted to circle back to what you said earlier, that there's something wrong with the whole for that to occur. Can you elaborate?
To give some understanding about, like the one author said that, but she talked about South African rape statistics, and she said the only countries with a higher rape statistics than South Africa are countries at war. Very painful, you know, and I think it's something that deeply troubles me. If you could see, my desk is a mess because I'm actually in the final phases now of preparing for my school belonging project for the first time. I'm going into schools. I created a program for boys to just to create belonging for boys and then to look at whether that might impact the academic performance, because globally, academic performance among boys are down dramatically. And for the young men in South Africa, when they don't do well in school, there are only two pathways for them. The one is to prison and the one is to the grave. And they die in wars. The highest rates of homicides is black men killing other black men. You know, it's astounding, shocking. I guess I'm hoping that my project in the schools, that it's generating already enormous interest, you know, and I'm just hoping that it would lead to a better understanding of decoding male way of expressing distress. It doesn't look like they're asking for help, but actually it's a huge alarm bell going off. So I think that if you look at what colonizers have done in South Africa, I think we tend to not speak about it in a way that allows for, and I'm talking about us South Africans, you know, we haven't created broad-based context spaces where we can just tell the stories of what had happened. So we have never healed from almost 400 years, and in 50 years of the most organized apartheid rule, firstly with that loss of the land, and they were systematically, you know, and it was done in a very violent way because they did offer resistance in South Africa, if you go back 2 centuries, whatever. But as you can also see in America, what Germany did with the Namibians, the first genocide of the 20th century, if you look at the man-made famine of the British in India, so it's just like, you know, when it's horrible. So, you know, I understand what drives that kind of, you know, we've never dealt with what has been done to us. So we are also just turning the cycles of violence on ourselves. And I think particularly in South Africa, I feel there is a lack of basic empathy and compassion for the kind of violence that, because you must also understand how your colonizer, they target the masculine sources of every society that they go into. Once you destabilize the men, you then pull the rug out of the whole system of, because it's connected, it's not separate. It's even now, as I'm speaking about it to you, it's making me very sad. Sure. It's very, very sad.
Yeah, I understand. It makes me sad for our whole globe, because it may be particularly bad in South Africa, but it's bad everywhere. It really resonates with me what you're saying about that there's a rift, a broken something about the whole that's causing this. We absolutely cannot say it's just men. or it's men's fault, or put it at men's feet. It's something broken with a hole. And I think you're right in that the West needs to go back and find out what happened. What's the original injury?
I'm happy to be the shrink. I mean, part of that panel. Because it will need to be like a huge panel. Yep.
But I think the work that you're doing is so key and so important to humanize and unify and promote belonging amongst us all. Somebody said, I forget what feminist said, the best weapon patriarchy created was compartmentalization, the old divide and conquer psychology, that if you pull things apart, you can dominate it. And so you're putting things back together.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I'm putting things together for other people. I think I'm putting things together for myself, you know. I think working with men has been so healing for me. I've just been blown away by the loyalty that I've been getting from men. Their helpfulness when they come to the practice and it's time for the men's group. They open and close windows, they organize the chairs, you know, they make sure the place is, you know, back together. They don't leave. You will see there will always be one that will wait until I'm safe, you know. And I don't see it as they're patronizing me. No, I see it as, okay, this guy, this is the values that he comes from, you know, that he looks after, he must protect and whatever. And I find that we have become here in South Africa, particularly for me, there's a disconnect between many of the academics and the local population. Because one of the things that I'm very critical of is that many of the academics are very socialized with this very mechanistic equality and gender equity and human rights. And, you know, and human rights for me, it can't be abstracted, okay? And every culture has human rights. You have to indigenize it, okay? And in a South African context, you can't come with human rights in the absence of the national foundation, because that's how we as Africans see ourselves. We see ourselves as belonging, and then through that belonging, my obligations, morality, how I ought to treat you. That's what I find with men is I come with a belonging, we connect, but I'm very clear about rules, right? I'm not like, I'm not your average, like also pushover. I'm very sweet. Yeah. But I come with, we connect, we belong, we are together, we are the same. The minute I do that, they come close. And when they come close, they begin to say, shoot, this is not right. You know, they begin to renegotiate their manhood identities. They are open to dispense of the definition of what it means to be a man. In an instant, they'll say, no, this is not working. And that is why you also need to pair men with other men, because the psychoanalyst Michael Diamond, who writes prolifically also about manhood and from a psychoanalytic perspective, he talks about how men have a lifetime to renegotiate what it means to be a man. And I see men doing that. And this is where, for me, the disconnect often comes with some of the local work on masculinities. I feel that many have just taken the definition of gender from another place. So gender, in our context, must have what my one colleague, he's a professor here at the University of the Western Cape, Professor Sakumzi Mfetshane. And Sakumzi says that our understanding of masculinity, it has an inner essence, which the ones that the imported understanding of masculinity that they are mostly working with in South Africa, it doesn't have an inner essence. It's what I would call, they operate on empty masculinities in the sense of Philip Cushman. Masculinities that is devoid of context. So they come with the human rights and the gender equity and all of that, as if it's foreign to our context, mind you. Okay. And so they fail to connect for me with local men, because what I find the quickest way here to connect with local men, don't come into a place and you want to tell people who they must be. You must respect people's own values and who they are. And then you find your connection through their values and through their definitions of who they are. What I find people want to do here is they want to tell men, no, no, you must, without first connecting with the men from where they are. So you are Xhosa men, you believe in this initiation, manhood, whatever, or you are Zulu men, you believe you are born men, you don't have to go through initiation. I want my first find out what is the definition of the values. What's the values hierarchy for you? And you know why, Andy? You know, the work that I do is actually a bit of cultural, psychological anthropology, right? So that's why it took also a long time for me to understand what I was doing, right? Because I'm cross-disciplinary. So what is the point that I want to make around why anthropology is so important? And the problem for me with the curriculum of psychology, because I used to train psychologists, right, is the absence of understanding of anthropology of people. Because when you go into all these indigenous places, and you can see at the surface the way the Eskimos does it, and then you go to the Incas, the Latin Americans, and then you see how they do it. Then you go to India, go to some village there in, you know, Central Africa, and you see on the surface, you will see it's different. When you go deeper, you will find that cultures who have never gotten in touch with each other, you will see they tend to do similar things. Respect for the elders, education, children must taught, children must... We are the same, Ellie. We are the same. So why is it that we want to address men with foreign concepts? First, connect with who the men are, and then they will give you permission. And once they give you permission, there's no turning back. Sure, I can speak a lot.
No, I love that. Thank you. That's a great place to wrap up, actually. All right. Well, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you for listening to Subject to Power. You can find the show online at subjecttopower.com or subscribe to the show wherever you find your podcasts. I'd love to know your thoughts on these conversations, so please drop a note on the website or find us on social media. The best way to support the show is to rate and review Subject to Power on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other listeners find us. Subject to Power is written, hosted, and produced by me, El Kamihira. Audio engineering is done by Jason Sheasley at Abridged Audio. Cover art by B. Johnson. And music by Beware of Darkness.